Okay. It is 8:48 a.m., Wednesday, October 23rd. This is the in-person interview of Scholars Academy Sunny Slope. The board and technical review panel appreciate that you have come today. We understand that the application process requires time, effort, and intensive commitment, and we wish to thank you for your interest in providing quality educational choices to the children of Arizona. The purpose of this interview is for the applicant to demonstrate how well it understands and has thought through the plan presented in the written application. The interview panel will use the responses to the questions to evaluate the capacity of the applicant to successfully implement the plan as outlined in the application. We will start with the introduction of the interview panel.
Good morning, I'm Whitney Marsh. I'm currently the Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Arizona Board of Regents. I was formerly the Executive Director of the Charter Board and spent some time in the Governor's Office doing K-12 budget as well.
I'm Carrie Larson. I'm the Executive Director of School Improvement at ASU Prep.
I'm Kyla Reed. I am Board President for Reed Traditional Schools. Over the last 25 years, I've worked with charter schools both locally and nationally.
Mm-hmm. All right, and this is Jessie Burke. She's also with board staff. Mm-hmm. I will now go over the details of today's interview. This interview will last 90 minutes. The procedures and ground rules for the interview process are as follows. You'll be given 5 minutes for introductions and to make your opening statement. I will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining and when the 5 minutes is complete. Expect to send 2 to 3 minutes on the initial response to each question, allowing time for any follow-up questions made by the interview panel. And feel free to ask for any clarification. In order to give you the opportunity to respond to all of our questions, during the response to an individual question, the TRP team lead may ask you to move on and give you the opportunity to address any other responses in your closing statement. When 10 minutes remain in the interview period, you'll be asked to make a closing statement of no more than 5 minutes, and I'll cue you when we reach that time. We will conclude the interview with a description of the next steps. Do you have any questions about the procedure or ground rules for this interview?
I do have one. The opening is 5 minutes for all of us, right?
Not per person, but
for all total. Yeah. For total. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Abbreviating in my head.
Yes. Well, I'll now turn things over to the TRP team lead who will be running the interview from here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kathy.
Yes.
So we'll start off, if you could please introduce your team and include what role each member played in the application process, as well as what role each member intends to have when the charter is approved, and then if you can follow with your opening statement.
My name is Elaine Baldridge. I'm a board member currently at a charter school, but I am involved in this one because I so strongly believe in good programming for kids in the Sunny Slope area. I worked for 40-something years as the Director of Program Services at the Foundation for Blind Children, which is in Sunny Slope at 12th Street in Northern, and grew up in the area, so I am very familiar with the area, have lived in Arizona all my life. I'm very committed to good education for all kids. I have a daughter who is blind and who went through the systems here in Arizona, but I also went to work at the foundation before I had her, and my interest was in good education for special needs kids particularly, but for all kids. I have two other kids who are not special needs, so, well, they're not kids. I have two other adults who were kids at one time. I'm married. I have two kids that are boys, and my daughter, who is blind, and she is adopted and from another culture as well. Anything else you want to know?
My name is Jason Romero. I'm an attorney. I'm an attorney who didn't think he would ever do anything in education law. I wasn't part of the plan, but has never been far on the tether from education. I clerked my first year out of law school for Justice Ruth McGregor, who became Chief Justice during that time. Spent a couple years teaching before she went to law school. She famously clerked for Justice O'Connor, who also spent time teaching before she went to law school. My wife is a teacher of deaf and hard of hearing, special education. my formidable essential parent figure in my life was my sixth grade teacher, who then took me under wing and helped me kind of became a little bit of a North Star, got me going in the right direction. And now I have two children who are adopted. One has an IEP and one has a 504. So I, thankfully I have my wife, so I sit in meetings and the acronym soup comes at me and I just tell her to tell me what that means later. But I've learned a lot that way. I've also been involved in charter schools. I was on the board of a charter school for 5 years and have helped charter schools with some legal issues as well, both in personnel, HR, facilities, kind of the gamut. And there's any number of issues that arise, you know, with charter schools. I've been working with Tim on this school for, well, since he said I want to do it. Tim and I have a unique history in that we both attended Washington High School, which is not too far down the road from where we're hoping this school will end up being located. I played baseball games, ran cross country at Sunny Slope High School, you know, have a real good connection to the community, and just really thought, man, if we could bring what I think is a proven strategy to an underserved population, I really want to be a part of that. And so I re-upped. And so I'm now the chairman of the board currently, and foresee that will go on for a fair amount of time.
And I'm a much older graduate of Washington
That's
High
right.
School,
oh, goodness,
which
yeah,
is also how I know Tim at a much younger age.
My name is Tim Boykin. First of all, thank you all for the opportunity to be here. I'm the founder of a charter school, no longer the director there, but upon leaving it was an A-rated charter school, Title I in Glendale, called Ethos Academy. Loved the school. I grew up in that community, but I also concurrently grew up in Sunny Slope. And so I've had a dream and a desire to want to serve and help the Sunny Slope area. My desire to serve this community and the plan that we are presenting before you is based off of proven results, but I do want to let you know that we're not resting on our laurels and we're not hoping that we get approved because of something we did. But my hope is that the application and especially this interview will communicate to you what we are going to do, both in enrolling, locating a facility to get it off the ground, but more importantly, the actual service for the coming decades for students and their families in the Sunny Slope area. And so we are excited to be here. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't nervous. The joke was I had a beard this morning. I got so nervous I accidentally, accidentally shaved half of it off. my daughter told me I needed to go ahead and change it. But even though I'm nervous and even though I'm, you know, I'm obviously identifying that, I'm incredibly excited and passionate about this community and the model that we have before.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Does that include your opening statement?
Yeah, if I can elaborate with the opening statement. Scholars Academy Sunny Slope is likely going to appear in the 85029 zip code. We have identified 85020 as well. It's near 7th Street and Dunlap. I say that we have a specific location because prior to the application, we provided three locations, but we have really zeroed in on and have made incredible gains in terms of identifying the very specific location and the neighborhoods and communities that we're going to serve. The model that we are incorporating is going to be a direct instruction model based off of core knowledge. It's a model that we've used previously at an A-rated school. It is incredibly dedicated to an RTI model that specifically addresses both micro and macro level intervention needs for the students. In addition to that, our mission statement, if I could elaborate a little bit for you, is to empower all students to be successful in 21st century careers in college by doing five things: providing strategic academic programs, including a growth mindset, supporting student needs, their basic needs must be met and we must be a part of that process, by engaging parents in the process, that means it's more than just communicating, it's engaging them, by partnering with local community leaders, which we've already been doing, and developing exceptional educators, which is a constant process. It's not a once a semester process. We have found that if we commit to those five things and have systems and protocols within each of those categories, we have found it to be an incredibly powerful recipe for academic growth and also addressing the wellness of students in the school.
Thank you. Perfect timing. Mm-hmm. So with that, we will move on to our questions.
I was interested in your calendar.
Sure.
And I was wondering, do you plan to have parent conferences? If so, why? Or if not, why? And how will you fit that into the schedule?
Absolutely. So the parent, I'm going to quickly say that we actually at one point had what we called parent academic nights when I first got into admin. And it was I remember going to trainings on it and all that. One of the things that we found, especially within the Title I community, though, was that we have a lot of parents that are single parents. There's an epidemic with regards to the lack of fathers with a lot of the kids. And our research has shown that's consistent with Sunny Slope. So the idea of offering one night in which we bring everybody together is not always the most convenient for those families, because they might have to work or they might have issues with childcare. So we are going to have parent conferences at Scholars Academy Sunny Slope. It's twofold, though. There is a formal time in which we will meet with parents, and we have them scheduled once a semester. However, part of our, if I could go back to the engaging parent philosophy and model of our school, the idea of engaging a parent means that we're not waiting for a conference for them to be engaged in that process. So we meet, and when I say that we meet, it's a daily, weekly process. But our team and our teachers and our staff meet with parents constantly. If I have a student who is struggling in a particular classroom, the requirement is that that teacher is actively involved with that parent from the get-go. We have an informal requirement that you need to learn three things unique about each kid and one thing unique about each parent prior to the school year starting. So we contact them by phone and we meet with them. But to your point, the parent conferences themselves cannot be relegated to just the informal process. We also have to have a time where we bring them in and go over data. So we offer NWEA benchmark data that will be provided in August, once in December, and once in May. So the follow-up to those data reports, which are then put into what we call student action plans, are then communicated in the formal setting where we bring a parent in and show them their data for their child, what our goals are, and what we plan on doing. Going back to the very first part of our mission statement, it's strategic academics. So we're going to identify for that parent in those conferences what are the strategies that we intend to provide in order to increase the growth and the proficiency for that student.
And I'm on the board because parents are my thing. They were my thing at the Foundation for Blind Children. Parents who weren't involved, their kids were never going to be independent. Parents who were, they were to the best level. We also served multiply handicapped, blind, and visually impaired kids. So the whole parent model is very important to me in being on this board.
If I understand it, then your parent conferences would not be during the school day.
It depends. We would base those parent conferences on the availability of the parents. And so if we have, like, for example, if we had a particular class where we had a teacher that had the ability, keep in mind our class sizes are very small, so we're not having to churn through 30-something of these meetings per week. But our ability to be able to meet with that parent, if on a given day we had a teacher within the prescribed week, and that would be soon after the initial benchmark test, we would then make those accommodations logistically where we would provide the opportunity. So in our, we have a program that will be used at Scholars called Campaigns. And so within our campaign, I didn't dig a lot into it in the application because there wasn't a convenient place, but we have a campaign. So one of the things that I learned in my years of being a vice principal and also my initial years with Ethos, my first school, was that logistically you cannot have certain staff members assigned to five major tasks in a given 1 or 2 week period. So we actually have set aside campaign blocks of 2 to 3 weeks. So our staff knows that we're going to have an emphasis, for example, on the parent conference, or we have an emphasis on the policies and procedures in the beginning of the school year. So we will occasionally have conferences outside of the school day, to answer your question, if that is in the best interest of the parents that we're serving. And our staff are aware of, because it's in that campaign, that there may be some flexibility required for them to accommodate the parents, but that's different.
Okay. Okay, so that helps me, if I understand that correctly, then the reason it doesn't show up in the calendar itself is because of the flexibility of meeting everybody's needs?
That's correct. Yes, okay. We have to be flexible to the unique needs of the community. I served at a North Phoenix school, not too far from Reed, by the way, and I'll fall short of saying I'm very impressed by your school, by the way, because it sounds like I'm trying to, get in. But as you can imagine, that was pretty self-aware. But the community that we served in North Phoenix, our ability to offer a schedule that was a lot more static wasn't that hard. But the community that we plan on serving requires some fluidity and some flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I've got a slightly more logistical question. Thinking about when teachers will start working, and if that's different than the contract start date, especially in the founding year, how will that work? When will they start? How are you going to work through that?
So I'm going to jokingly say that, and I don't mean jokingly, but I'm going to give you kind of an insight into, we call something, it's called flight school. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be the Storks, the Sunny Slope Storks. We have a whole thing on that. Right? That's for another time. But flight school, on a serious note, is where we bring the teachers in. In the first year, they'll all be there for 2 weeks. As a teacher has provided through our continuous improvement plan and through our coaching model of visitations, observations, evaluations, in future years, there is some flexibility. So we have certain teachers that do not have to be there for the full 2 weeks. Most of them will do. It is during that time that we provide them what we call a foundations training, where we go over all of the nuances, basically our application in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. But more specifically, it's where we begin the process of developing highly effective teachers through curriculum instruction assessment, going through making sure that all of the very specific grade level requirements, both for the state compliance but also for our specific model, are implemented and in place. And so that's what we provide in the beginning prior to the first day of school. In addition to that, there is an orientation for parents that we require the staff to be there for. That's separate from their PD.
And it looks like in some parts of the application, maybe calendar-wise, does some of that start before the contracted start date?
Yeah, so their contracted day is actually, technically, it's 190 days, as mentioned in the application. Those 190 take into account the 10 additional days above and beyond the 180.
Okay.
And so we've taken that into account with regards to the schedule.
Okay, so that's part of the flight school is part of
that is
their contracted.
Yeah, day. Yeah, okay. They're going to be contracted for that. So the budget we present, therefore, we're not going to get caught in one of those situations where we have to somehow come up with $5,000 for an additional professional development here.
Yeah.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about the curriculum adoption process and who's reviewing, evaluating, and approving the curriculum, and if the board has a role in that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm going to apologize that I'm going to be taking the lead on a lot of these things. I will speak specifically to the adoption, though. So in going back and looking at the rubric that we received 2 weeks ago where that was identified as missing, the arrogant person in me wanted to say, oh, they missed it, right? So I come here humble, and I went back and looked, and here's what I believe happened, and here's what I hope will satisfy the discrepancy. We're a core knowledge school. That is from the get-go. That was from the beginning. Jason and I were the original two board members. Elaine is now the third board member. We have four others already in queue that we can get into and discuss later. We have adopted from the beginning that we are a core knowledge school. Core knowledge is a scope and sequence, though. One of the misnomers about core knowledge is that it's not a curriculum per se. There are resources. But as we all know, or I shouldn't assume this, but my belief on curriculum is a curriculum is separate from a textbook. Textbook is a resource that can help complement the development of the curriculum. So I think what happened, and I apologize for this, but I can assure you that we have already adopted the scope and sequence to the degree that is relevant with regards especially to core knowledge specific items. However, there is a discrepancy between core knowledge's scope and sequence and the standards for math, some of the science, and some of the developmental stages with regards to English and language arts. They do have a curriculum resource provided by Amplify called CKLA that has helped to bridge that gap though. So we have adopted core knowledge and the standards that are correlated to the state. We will follow that scope and sequence, but we have already adopted the resources that are a complement to that curriculum. For me, my requirement with staff though, and we've included this in the budget, we have a curriculum development budget in the startup phase. I was actually questioned on how does that correlate to this adoption of the curriculum, so I apologize if I'm going off base for just a second. But because we understand curriculum is not simply just a purchase order to a company and then it's the arrival of the materials, that might be the outcome for us to be able to develop the curriculum. We have actually put into our budget that we will be developing that curriculum in conjunction with the development and start of the school year. So we have adopted curriculum, and I believe that if you look at point one, two, and three on those steps, that was my attempt to be more exhaustive instead of just saying we adopt and then explaining it. I probably got too cute with that and kind of out-talked it, and when I went back to it, I couldn't believe that I had not written the word adopt, so I apologize, but the question is very valid, and we do have a process for that, and that is in place. I just think that as a core knowledge school, it's already in place, and so I failed to just communicate that to the panel.
Yeah, and I'll just add, since we can't let him do all the talking with an attorney sitting up here.
I'll add from the board perspective, we do in the past, in our experiences, obviously, with in the previous charter school, the board is involved in the adoption of the curriculum, but we do already have the adoption and the understanding of the scope and sequence of core knowledge. So as I view our role, what we sort of do as the board, because we're not the full-time thinkers and we're not the expert, I certainly couldn't sit here and give you a dissertation on exactly what core knowledge is and how it works. I've tried to read the book, and I've gotten through most of it. But what we do is we say, okay, we get the general idea of what core knowledge scope and sequence is, and we know there's standards, and there's some places where we kind of have to make the square peg and the round hole fit, and then we ask our full-time thinkers to do that and then present it to us as a board and show us how it's going to work. And that's what has happened in the past, and then we look at it and go, okay, we think that's going to get us there, we adopt that, and then of course we're constantly reviewing the data to see if that's actually working. And in fact, I think it's been 5 years, we've had some course changes where we said, yeah, that...
In our first year of our previous school, we had to do that right away.
Yeah.
We saw some discrepancies between the data and the resource that was supporting the curriculum.
And so we went back and had the resource change and then adopted the resource, which was more successful. So that does happen, I think, on an annual basis. We've done that in the past year.
Yeah, around June.
I noticed that you'll have your lead teachers evaluating and coaching other teachers. So how does that work? Are you getting offer them release time or compensation for additional work?
So that, in year one and possibly year two, we do not, like there's the immediate year of that approach versus like what it will be once we are built out and we're up to the 450 and we have our full team. In the beginning, that won't happen because we will have, 10 classes, and myself and the campus team will be able to provide that support. There are occasions where in our development of every teacher, because every teacher has a development plan, every single one of them, some of their coaching requirements are greater than others. Those teachers where we find, and we already have several that are going to be joining our team that are already there, will, as a part of their PLC time, when the data has already been evaluated and we're in step with that, will participate in observing and seeing other teachers. I shouldn't use the word observing in the sense that they're not going to be doing an observation, the formal observation that's presented in the application. But we do like for lead teachers to be actively involved. On a campus that I'm a part of, and the campus that we will have as scholars, the culture of having staff, especially admin, come into a classroom it's just part of the culture. It's part of the interview process to make sure that we know someone's not going to be inhibited or feel insecure. Developing relationships is key. And so because of that, I have been on campuses where if you brought in a lead teacher, and there's no relationship and there's not a culture where this is the norm, it can actually be disastrous. However, on our campus, we have found it's actually embraced and wanted. So there will come a point where that becomes more and more the norm. But in the first year, when we're trying to establish that all of our policies and procedures are tight, it's not going to be as common, if at all, especially in the first semester.
But your lead teachers eventually would be leaving their class to go observe?
No, they would do that when during one of their prep times, or like, you know, we have a PLC that's scheduled once a week during their prep time. And so that occasionally that will happen during those times. If need be, we've had, as an example, we've actually had, you know, brought in like a substitute teacher or what have you. We have a budget of $9,000 for that. So occasionally we will have a substitute teacher if the development plan for that specific teacher was to go visit, let's say, 3 or 4 classrooms. We've done that. But I don't foresee that being as much the norm in the beginning as it would be later on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another logistical,
sure.
Clarifying question. The reporting structure for teachers and the special education teachers, to who exactly do they report to, and if there's some division of responsibilities in reporting, how does that work, just so okay. Teachers don't feel like they have multiple, you know,
sure. I'll let you want to speak to the beginning of that one, and then I'll follow up with how it relates to all teachers.
Well, we want our principal and our dean to both be people that they are comfortable and know that they can report to, but also to know that oversight is by both the principal and that dean. Because it's a contracted provider, we didn't put that line in there very well. So I'm sorry about that. But the goal is to have the principal, and that's very important again to me with my special ed background, that both the providers feel comfortable and have access, and that there is good oversight so that if there are any problems with providers, they're caught right away.
And so to that end, on page 5 of that applicant narrative, there were 2 paragraphs that sounded contradictory. So to, you know, I believe Elena explained that. So I'll explain it then in the greater context of all the teachers, is that make no mistake that as a school principal, I am the academic leader of this campus. I am also the operations leader of the campus. I have a campus dean who I work with, you know, at a very intimate level to make sure that our oversight for everything regarding academics and students is in place. SPED is one of those incredibly important parts of a school. Obviously, you can tell from the background of the team that's here, SPED is a strength for us. Even though it's a strength, though, we actually have identified that, especially for the model we have, that having a provider, and we've listed steps, but it's possible that we're actually in the process, assuming we get approved, where we have another organization that we're looking at, another provider that might be a little bit more efficient and a little bit more capable. We're vetting that. But the reason for that is that the laws that change are considerable. When you have a SPED teacher that you hire for only 10 classrooms and a budget that's going to be smaller for a first-year charter school, it is absolutely imperative that we have a provider that has access to a variety of specialists within the special ed field.
That's so really important to me,
yeah,
because the needs are different. You can't have a general special ed teacher be the provider for a blind child or a visually impaired child or a deaf child or a child that's out of their background.
Right.
And having a provider gives us access both to PT, OT, speech, and specialties in other areas as needed for the individual children that show up.
And so to that end, I will attend the IEP meetings, I will attend, you know, MET meetings, and I am 100% actively involved. But it's so important that we also would like, and we'll have the campus dean a part of that process too. And so that's what we intended to communicate with the narrative and with the organizational chart. It gave the appearance that somehow the principal might be detached from that process, and that's just not the case.
So if the principal, if you are satisfied with what's going on academically, but your dean is not satisfied with the organization or some other such thing, what happens?
Well, first off, we do not have a culture where I'm a very forthright individual, and the people that I lead and the staff will tell you that I'm very forthright, but I'm incredibly respectful. But at the end of the day, the buck stops with me. And as the principal, I will be the one that will determine and dictate what is in the best interest of the kids as it relates to compliance, et cetera. We actually already know who our campus dean is, actually. And so that individual is anxiously awaiting, you know, the results of our application. But that individual, even though he has some incredible strengths, I have a stronger background with that, and we have a board that has a stronger background. I will take the advice from the campus dean, but ultimately I'm the one that's going to make that decision. But I would be lying to you if I told you I'm a special ed guru. And so that's why we have identified the use of a provider to be so much more important, both with compliance and also with providing the actual minutes. And so it's a collaborative effort, but when you collaborate, you ultimately have to have decisions made. And so we will defer to the laws regarding the compliance of SPED as provided with the assistance of the provider that we have.
One of the nice things from the board perspective, working with an outside provider, I've seen both. Like I said, my wife teaches in special education, so I've seen really good and less effective leadership from a single SPED director in a district that, you know, may or may not have an understanding of my wife's specialties, right? And so I hear that at night over the dinner table, like, well, they're making these decisions, but they don't understand deaf and hard of hearing kids. And I think, well, that makes sense, right? But I also understand you're managing a huge SPED program, and how do you do that? So this is an aside, but there seems to be a move away from specialty in SPED lately, and so I hear, and I don't think this is all bad, but I hear a lot about we need to teach the classroom teachers how to do that. You're now coaches for the classroom teachers. From the background of seeing somebody who really works in the field, I think that's not going to be very effective. I think that's not going to work. And from the background of having students, one who has an IEP and one who has a 504 plan, I can tell you, I don't want that. I want somebody who has a specialty that understands how to get results for my daughter or my son. And I know the classroom teacher, especially in some of these classrooms with 35 kids, can't accomplish that, even though they're great teachers. So I think having the outside provider who has access to specialists is like my job when I have to go find an expert, because, yeah, I'm a lawyer, but I don't understand chemical engineering, and I got to go find a chemical engineer for that. That makes sense to me. And so from a board perspective, this has always been the smart decision, is have somebody who has that access and can bring in those tools. From the legal perspective, I've enjoyed working with an outside provider because I have someone who, and we have had in the past, where our board will actually also meet with the provider and say, okay, well, now we want to make sure that we have the policies and procedures in place to address rule changes, or, you know, this new opinion came out, what can we do to make sure we're, and then we have this outside provider who's already thinking about that because they're dealing with it for however many number of schools that they're providing for. It just takes a little bit of the pressure off the board, who's looking at the lawyer sitting on the board going, what do we do now, you know, right? Well, we look at our specialists and we ask them for their help and their input. So I think it's the right way to go. I know other schools have brought in like a single person to run their SPED program, and some of them do really well, but I think this seems to be the right approach to them.
Yeah, and to piggyback, even though there's a provider and specialist, I do want to also make sure that what's not communicated is that a regular education teacher is not somehow developed and or familiar with how to provide the accommodations or modifications. We are not saying that we're removing that from the process at all. We're just saying that we take it and we value it to such a degree, we just want to have somebody that is an expert on the most common compliance requirements. However, at the end of the day, I will directly be working with the SPED department and with the campus dean on that process.
So it's a combination of in-class and pull-out?
Well, we are inclusive, right? However, we do pull out when we provide minutes, especially certain minutes that are required by the IEP for certain skills and certain, you know, requirements. But so we have all that in place, and we have passed all of our audits in previous schools, and I think we have found a good model that is not just a decent model for SPED, but it is exceptional.
And I don't want to spend all our time on SPED, we obviously have a heart for it, but what really won me over, I was already on a board, we were going, it's like, well, I think it's going to work, and then what won me over with, I was actually asked at our last, many years ago, the interview process like this, you know, how are you guys going to particularly set up to deal with special education? And they asked me for some reason, as if, like, why would I know? You know, I'm just a lawyer. But what I know is I have the experience of my own children in their schools. And I remember when I'm sitting in parent-teacher conferences, they're going, okay, your daughter's not going to get this. We're just going to move on. I'm like, whoa, time out. Like, do we have some interventions? And I know what an intervention is because of what I was doing, right, and understanding what this intervention model looks like. They say, yeah, well, we might have a parent come in and, you know, sit with a few of the kids. And I'm like, no, that's not an intervention, you know. And then realizing when we got into the IEP process, well, those are kind of the interventions, you know. And so once we got in the IEP process, we started to be provided with those interventions. But honestly, Scholars Academy is already starting that with every student, right? So we're already sort of set up for the model of individualized education planning. I think we call it an SAP or whatever this.
Yeah, we have student action plans.
Student action plans. So that it's not like just me and my wife, because we know how to make sure we're getting all of the things we need for our special education daughter. And then I see other parents that don't get those things because they don't know how to ask for them. Every student is expected to have an individualized education plan to a certain extent at Scholars.
We don't call them that.
No, we don't call them that, right. But so pullouts is sort of part of the process because everybody's getting an intervention, right? We're looking for growth, and so the interventions are based on, here's the data, this group needs this intervention for this growth. But special ed, not special ed, doesn't matter, you're all getting that intervention at some level. And so then special ed is just sort of an extension of that. Now you need it for maybe the specific issues happen.
I just want to add that some of you may know, but blind children were the first children fully included in special ed in the state of Arizona before special ed was required. My daughter was fully included as a totally blind student from kindergarten on. She was in a specialized preschool, and she had specialized intervention in her fully included school, where she was pulled out because her classroom teacher did not know how to teach the next level of Braille, for example. But she was fully included many, many years ago, 42. And I worked with kids who were being included fully before it was required. The foundation was started in 52. Special ed was not required until in the 70s, as you know. I'm committed to kids being fully included, but also getting the services they need so that being fully included actually works,
right,
as opposed to not working.
Thank you. Can you describe the board structure? Explain it a little bit, specifically the governance and administration as it relates to the corporate and governing board.
Sure. So when it comes to the board, by and large, the corporate and governing board are going to be code the same. The nomenclature tends to trip people up when we start talking about officers. So directors kind of make sense, but we start talking about officers. Do you have a president, or do you have a chairman? So we've tried to use the nomenclature to separate those things. There have to be corporate officers, right? And there are, and those are really ministerial tasks, right? There's things the Corporation Commission needs corporate officers to do. So we've tried to identify those as president, secretary, vice president, that sort of thing. With respect to the board officers, those are less ministerial and they're very active positions. And so you have a chairman, a vice chairman, a secretary, and a treasurer of the board. Those are going to be active working positions. They're not necessarily, and I think with respect to the chairman and the secretary, can't be the same people, if I recall that. So the really functional offices are the board, chairman, vice chairman, secretary, and treasurer, who are also obviously directors on the board. And then obviously we have, for purposes of signing paperwork, submitting things to the ACC, we have our corporate officers, president, vice president, secretary. In terms of governance, the board and its board officers are the governing body.
So they're going to oversee the director primarily, but also our, you know, the buck kind of actually stops here, if I don't want to take a look, but the buck actually stops at the board level with respect to curriculum, outcome results, budget compliance. I mean, obviously we're not the day-to-day thinkers, but if it doesn't work, it's actually our fault, because we're supposed to be supervising it. And so obviously there's a sort of symbiotic relationship in that we're relying on our day-to-day thinkers, and in particular relying on our director, to both report clearly to us what's going on, and then also to implement what we're asking to be implemented at the school level. And then of course we're evaluating and making sure that's being done well. And then typically all of the hiring, firing decisions after that are really up to the director, and if he wants to push those down to dean levels, that's fine as well. And then in a good board relationship, though, you're still having those conversations where I think the previous question was, what if the director sees academics is going great, but the dean is saying, hey, I see a problem here. I believe this to be true of Tim in past experience, and I would hope it would be true of any director, that I would hear about that as a board member. And the director should say, hey, look, my dean is seeing this issue. I don't think it's an issue. Here's why I don't think it's an issue, and I'm going to make this call, but you guys let me know what you think, or, you know, push back on that, ask questions. And Tim has been incredibly good in the past at doing that, saying, hey, I think this is the right direction to go, but I want to hear pushback. And there have been times when the board has said, wait, we see a red flag that just, you know, wasn't something he would have seen around that corner, and then we've adjusted to it. So from a governance standpoint, though, I don't know if I'm exactly answering your question, but it's really the school board that's running things. The corporate board, the corporate directors, is really there just to, you know, make sure that the corporation is compliant with all of the laws of the state of Arizona. So.
And I was on the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind Board for a term, mm-hmm. and I went into that saying, I am a questioner and a pushback person, especially when it comes to some of these areas, and I won't be on a board where that's not okay. They asked me to be on it anyway. I don't know that they were quite prepared for some of my pushback, but anyway, that was my question also to Tim on the board. And Tim is incredibly good at asking for feedback and pushback from, again, people who know something that he may not know completely, and at taking it gracefully and graciously, and then doing something with it. That's why I'm on the board.
Is the school governing board, are all of those members of the school governing board also on the corporate board?
The governing board and the corporate board, I believe in the bylaws of the corporation, I should bring about, they are coextensive, yes. So at least initially that's true. It doesn't have to remain true, but initially they are coextensive boards, yes.
So do you plan to have the corporate officers will always be governing board members?
Yes. Yeah, I would not foresee a situation in which it would be a corporate officer that wouldn't be. Yeah.
All right, well, that wraps up our questions regarding the application. So now you will have 5 minutes. Is that correct?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Oh, yep, yeah, that's what the script says. To make a closing statement to the panel. Board staff will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining and when the 5 minutes is complete. You may begin.
All right. Again, thank you for your time. I appreciate the questions. The thing I appreciate is I saw a consistency between the response to the application in both phases, the first and second substantive review, and the questions that were asked. Something that, in addition to hopefully satisfying questions regarding those reviews, that I would like to share is this. We all, and I especially, and the team that we have in place, are 100% dedicated to the community that we are serving. This is not about us taking any model and just finding a community that we can fit into. We have a very genuine desire as to why we're wanting to be in this community. When I was younger, I was raised in Glendale and Sunny Slope, as I mentioned, but I spent extensive time in Sunny Slope as an adolescent. And later on, when I had to help out a relative who passed away, I was asked to take over being the executor of his will. And he had a bunch of these duplexes in this community. The reason why I want to go to Sunny Slope is because I spent so much time with families there, whether it was through some of the church activities that we did or through the schools. But I got to know those families specifically. We already have 20 families that are ready, assuming they get approved, to get onto our intensive enroll. We have many more that are willing to talk to us through a variety of preschools. I obviously would never get into talking about specific schools or have you, but I think it's a common and known fact that many of the schools that start and get approved for a charter sometimes do not get off the ground because they do not have a plan initially to reach certain enrollment targets. I can tell you that we have really put a lot of thought into that. We are confident in our ability to reach the certain number of kids that are going to be required for us to open the school. We have done extensive work with a variety of partners. And we have the Active Learning Center. We are working with UMOM, the local hospital, Sunny Slope High School, Thunderbird High School, the American Indian College, North Village Church, Trinity Lutheran. Little Swans Preschool has 4 or 5 kids that they're already really excited to bring our way. I really learned a lot in my previous experiences with either opening a school or being a part of an existing school. And I just want you guys to know, and I believe I speak for our entire team, that in a year from now, you're going to see a highly successful school in operation. And in 5 years from now, we're going to be a perennial, hopefully perennial A. But our standards are very high. And so it's more than just warm fuzzies. It's more than just simply meeting the basic needs, although that's important. And that's a priority. We are here to educate those kids and to provide them an academic opportunity that will last them well beyond their experience out of school. We're going to set the table for them for their future.
Can I add?
Absolutely.
I'm in one of my retirement jobs. I am what's called a UMOM ambassador, which means that I sit on a group that reaches out to families in poverty, obviously families who are homeless. I don't know if you know UMOM. It's the largest. You probably do. One of the things that UMOM has done in the last few years is build affordable housing in communities. And there is a wonderful, relatively new community project in Sunny Slope that I've known about and been involved in at the ambassador level since they were talking about it. So it's this area, again, for me also, it's very, very
I wouldn't dare leave 60 seconds on the table.
I will just say this, that I when I came into this initial 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, where Tim asked me, hey, would you consider being on a board at this charter school? And I said, I don't know anything about this, but sure, I'll try. I ask questions for a living. I think I can do that. Every step of the way, I've learned something. And you know, most people, most organizations, the closer you get, the more cracks you see. You know, from far, it looks like a perfect porcelain, and then you get closer, oh, there's some cracks. That has not been my experience working with Tim and working with the model that he's put into place. And I've pressed on it. I've said, okay, maybe I'm not seeing something, but we had a process which I know we will continue to do at Scholars in Sunny Slope, where we would have the board host a lunch once or twice a year with the teachers. No admin, just the teachers, and sit down and talk. And I could not believe how happy these teachers were, really happy. And my time is up, but I just want to say, so I pressed there and I saw the teachers were happy. My wife is a teacher, and I said, go visit the campus. Just tell me what you see. I want to hear your perspective. And she came back and she said two things that just really caught me. She said, number one, wow, I would have to really up my game to work here because the focus on professional development is intense. I mean, the administrators are in the classroom and working with these teachers all the time, and I'm used to just kind of being free to do my thing, and this would be hard. But she said, the other thing that you can't put on paper, but is so important, is the culture
of love and care for those kids, paid emotion about this, was evident. She said, I think Tim was walking around at one point. She said, anytime a kid walked up, I was second there. Knew the kid by name, turned, talked to him, whatever. She said, and that was true of the entire staff. It was a culture, this feeling of like, that kid and that kid's need is the number one thing right now. I don't care there's a VIP here, I get the kid in. I thought, well, yeah, you can't really write that. You just have to live it out. And so I'm proud to be serving with the board that does that. So anyway, sorry, I get emotional about that.
No apologies necessary. Thank you. So I'll go over the next steps now. To conclude the in-person interview, I will describe what will be happening next. The technical review panel will evaluate the scores from the review of your written application package, as well as the findings of the interview panel. This will include whether your written application package met the scoring criteria specified in the application, and whether the interview panel finds sufficient capacity to operate a charter school. Next, a recommendation report will be submitted to board staff and will be presented to the board at the December 9th meeting. This will be a full-day meeting that will begin at 9 a.m. We anticipate that this will be a long meeting, so please plan for the possibility of your application being considered on December 10th if the meeting runs long.
That's a long meeting.
Yes.
If you have any questions about the next steps, please contact Rachel Hanna, the board's assistant director of charter support and accountability. You have a copy of her card. And once again, the Arizona State Board of Charter Schools, the technical review panel, and board staff would like to thank you for coming in today and for your interest in providing quality educational choice to the children of Arizona.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your time.
Thank you. I have a question about the December 9th date. Mm-hmm. If we all have to be there?
We should, but if you're not able to make it, it's not the equivalent.
I have a son who is, he and his family are in Africa long term. Mm-hmm. He will be in LA during that time block. Mm-hmm. And as much as I love this.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Actually, Elaine, that'll be fine.
Yeah.
I can explain that. I'll have you
it
answer.
Depends on when you actually go. So I may be there.
Thanks again.
Thank you very much.